Chapter 38. For a moment, before this extraordinary find, they forgot their own concerns and sensations. Senor Hirsch's sensations as he lay there must have been those of extreme terror. For a long time he refused to give a sign of life, till at last Deckard's objurgations, and, perhaps more, Nostromo's impatient suggestion that he should be thrown overboard, as he seemed to be dead, induced him to raise one eyelid first, and then the other. It appeared that he had never found a safe opportunity to leave Sulaco. He lodged with Anzani, the universal storekeeper, on the Plaza Mayor. But when the riot broke out, he had made his escape from his host's house before daylight, and in such a hurry that he had forgotten to put on his shoes. He had run out impulsively in his socks, and with his hat in his hand, into the garden of Anzani's house. Fear gave him the necessary agility to climb over several low walls, and afterwards he blundered into the overgrown cloisters of the ruined Franciscan convent in one of the by streets. He forced himself into the midst of matted bushes with the recklessness of desperation, and this accounted for his scratched body and his torn clothing. He lay hidden there all day, his tongue cleaving to the roof of his mouth with all the intensity of thirst engendered by heat and fear. Three times different bands of men invaded the place with shouts and imprecations, looking for Father Corbelan. But towards the evening, still lying on his face in the bushes, he thought he would die from the fear of silence. He was not very clear as to what had induced him to leave the place, but evidently he had got out, and slunk successfully out of town along the deserted back lanes. He wandered in the darkness near the railway, so maddened by apprehension, that he dared not even approach the fires of the pickets of Italian workmen guarding the line. He had a vague idea evidently of finding refuge in the railway yards, but the dogs rushed upon him, barking. Men began to shout. A shot was fired at random. He fled away from the gates. By the merest accident, as it happened, he took the direction of the O.S.S.N. Company's offices. Twice he stumbled upon the bodies of men killed during the day. But everything living frightened him much more. He crouched, crept, crawled, made dashes, guided by a sort of animal instinct, keeping away from every light and from every sound of voices. His idea was to throw himself at the feet of Captain Mitchell and beg for shelter in the company's offices. It was all dark there as he approached on his hands and knees, but suddenly someone on guard challenged loudly, "Queen Vive?" There were more dead men lying about, and he flattened himself down at once by the side of a cold corpse. He heard a voice saying, "Here is one of those wounded rascals crawling about. Shall I go and finish him?" And another voice objected that it was not safe to go out without a lantern upon such an errand. Perhaps it was only some Negro liberal looking for a chance to stick a knife into the stomach of an honest man. Hirsch didn't stay to hear any more, but crawling away to the end of the wharf, hid himself amongst a lot of empty casks. After a while some people came along, talking, and with glowing cigarettes. He did not stop to ask himself whether they would be likely to do him any harm, but bolted incontinently along the jetty, saw a lighter lying moored at the end, and threw himself into it. In his desire to find cover he crept right forward under the half-deck, and he had remained there more dead than alive, suffering agonies of hunger and thirst, and almost fainting with terror, when he heard numerous footsteps and the voices of the Europeans who came in a body escorting the wagon load of treasure, pushed along the rails by a squad of cargadors. He understood perfectly what was being done from the talk, but did not disclose his presence from the fear that he would not be allowed to remain. His only idea at the time, overpowering and masterful, was to get away from this terrible Sulaco. And now he regretted it very much. He had heard Nostromo talk to Deckard, and wished himself back on shore. He did not desire to be involved in any desperate affair in a situation where one could not run away. The involuntary groans of his anguished spirit had betrayed him to the sharp ears of the Capitas. They had propped him up in a sitting posture against the side of the lighter, and he went on with the moaning account of his adventures till his voice broke, his head fell forward. "W. Water," he whispered, with difficulty. Deckard held one of the cans to his lips. He revived after an extraordinarily short time, and scrambled up to his feet wildly. Nostromo, in an angry and threatening voice, ordered him forward. Hirsch was one of those men whom fear lashes like a whip, and he must have had an appalling idea of the Capitas's ferocity. He displayed an extraordinary agility in disappearing forward into the darkness. They heard him getting over the tarpaulin. Then there was the sound of a heavy fall, followed by a weary sigh. Afterwards all was still in the fore part of the lighter, as though he had killed himself in his headlong tumble. Nostromo shouted in a menacing voice, "Lie still there. Do not move a limb. If I hear as much as a loud breath from you, I shall come over there and put a bullet through your head." The mere presence of a coward, however passive, brings an element of treachery into a dangerous situation. Nostromo's nervous impatience passed into gloomy thoughtfulness. Deckard, in an undertone, as if speaking to himself, remarked that, after all, this bizarre event made no great difference. He could not conceive what harm the man could do. At most he would be in the way, like an inanimate and useless object like a block of wood, for instance. "I would think twice before getting rid of a piece of wood," said Nostromo, calmly. "As something may happen unexpectedly, where you could make use of it. But in an affair like ours, a man like this ought to be thrown overboard. Even if he were as brave as a lion, we would not want him here. We are not running away for our lives. Senor, there is no harm in a brave man trying to save himself with ingenuity and courage. But you have heard his tale, Don Martin. His being here is a miracle of fear." Nostromo paused. "Here is no room for fear in this lighter," he added through his teeth. Deckard had no answer to make. It was not a position for argument, for a display of scruples or feelings. There were a thousand ways in which a panic-stricken man could make himself dangerous. It was evident that Hirsch could not be spoken to, reasoned with, or persuaded into a rational line of conduct. The story of his own escape demonstrated that clearly enough. Deckard thought that it was a thousand pities the wretch had not died of fright. Nature, who had made him what he was, seemed to have calculated cruelly how much he could bear in the way of atrocious anguish without actually expiring. Some compassion was due to so much terror. Deckard, though imaginative enough for sympathy, resolved not to interfere with any action that Nostromo would take. But Nostromo did nothing, and the fate of Senor Hirsch remained suspended in the darkness of the gulf at the mercy of events which could not be foreseen. The Capitas, extending his hand, put out the candle suddenly. It was to Deckard as if his companion had destroyed, by a single touch, the world of affairs, of loves, of revolution, where his complacent superiority analyzed fearlessly all motives and all passions, including his own. He gasped a little. Deckard was affected by the novelty of his position. Intellectually self-confident, he suffered from being deprived of the only weapon he could use with effect. No intelligence could penetrate the darkness of the placid gulf. There remained only one thing he was certain of, and that was the overweening vanity of his companion. It was direct, uncomplicated, naive, and effectual. Deckard, who had been making use of him, had tried to understand his man thoroughly. He had discovered a complete singleness of motive behind the varied manifestations of a consistent character. This was why the man remained so astonishingly simple in the jealous greatness of his conceit. And now there was a complication. It was evident that he resented having been given a task in which there were so many chances of failure. I wonder, thought Deckard, how he would behave if I were not here. He heard Nostromo mutter again, "No. There is no room for fear on this lighter. courage itself does not seem good enough. I have a good eye and a steady hand. No man can say he ever saw me tired or uncertain what to do. But poor Dios, Don Martin, I have been sent out into this black calm on a business, where neither a good eye, nor a steady hand, nor judgment are any use. He swore a string of oaths in Spanish and Italian under his breath. Nothing but sheer desperation will do for this affair. These words were in strange contrast to the prevailing peace, to this almost solid stillness of the gulf. A shower fell with an abrupt whispering sound all around the boat, and Deckard took off his hat, and, letting his head get wet, felt greatly refreshed. Presently a steady little draft of air caressed his cheek. The lighter began to move, but the shower distanced it. The drops ceased to fall upon his head and hands, the whispering died out in the distance. Nostromo emitted a grunt of satisfaction, and grasping the tiller, chirruped softly, as sailors do, to encourage the wind. Never for the last 3 days had Deckard felt less the need for what the Capitas would call desperation. I fancy I hear another shower on the water, he observed in a tone of quiet content. I hope it will catch us up. Nostromo ceased chirruping at once. Why, you hear another shower? He said, doubtfully. A sort of thinning of the darkness seemed to have taken place, and Deckard could see now the outline of his companion's figure, and even the sail came out of the night like a square block of dense snow. The sound which Deckard had detected came along the water harshly. Nostromo recognized that noise partaking of a hiss, and a rustle which spreads out on all sides of a steamer making her way through a smooth water on a quiet night. It could be nothing else but the captured transport with troops from Esmeralda. She carried no lights. The noise of her steaming, growing louder every minute, would stop at times altogether, and then begin again abruptly, and sound startlingly near, as if that invisible vessel, whose position could not be precisely guessed, were making straight for the lighter. Meantime, that last kept on sailing slowly and noiselessly before a breeze so faint that it was only by leaning over the side and feeling the water slip through his fingers that Deckard convinced himself they were moving at all. His drowsy feeling had departed. He was glad to know that the lighter was moving. After so much stillness, the noise of the steamer seemed uproarious and distracting. There was a weirdness in not being able to see her. Suddenly all was still. She had stopped, but so close to them that the steam, blowing off, sent its rumbling vibration right over their heads. They are trying to make out where they are, said Deckard in a whisper. Again he leaned over and put his fingers into the water. We are moving quite smartly, he informed Nostromo. We seem to be crossing her bows, said the Capitas in a cautious tone. But this is a blind game with death. Moving on is of no use. We mustn't be seen or heard. His whisper was hoarse with excitement. Of all his face there was nothing visible, but a gleam of white eyeballs. His fingers gripped Deckard's shoulder. That is the only way, to save this treasure from this steamer full of soldiers. Any other would have carried lights. But you observe there is not a gleam, to show us where she is. Deckard stood as if paralyzed. Only his thoughts were wildly active. In the space of a second he remembered the desolate glance of Antonia as he left her at the bedside of her father in the gloomy house of Avellanos, with shuttered windows, but all the doors standing open, and deserted by all the servants except an old negro at the gate. He remembered the Casa Gould on his last visit, the arguments, the tones of his voice, the impenetrable attitude of Charles, Mrs. Gould's face so blanched with anxiety and fatigue, that her eyes seemed to have changed color, appearing nearly black by contrast. Even whole sentences of the proclamation which he meant to make Barrios issue from his headquarters at Cayta, as soon as he got there passed through his mind. The very germ of the new state, the separationist proclamation which he had tried, before he left to read hurriedly to Don Jose, stretched out on his bed under the fixed gaze of his daughter. God knows whether the old statesman had understood it. He was unable to speak, but he had certainly lifted his arm off the coverlet. His hand had moved, as if to make the sign of the cross in the air, a gesture of blessing, of consent. Deckard had that very draft in his pocket, written in pencil on several loose sheets of paper, with the heavily printed heading, Administration of the Santome Silver Mine. Sulaco. Republic of Costaguana. He had written it furiously, snatching page after page on Charles Gould's table. Mrs. Gould had looked several times over his shoulder as he wrote, but the senior administrator, standing straddle-legged, would not even glance at it when it was finished. He had waved it away firmly. It must have been scorn, and not caution, since he never made a remark about the use of the administration's paper for such a compromising document. And that showed his disdain, the true English disdain of common prudence, as if everything outside the range of their own thoughts and feelings were unworthy of serious recognition. Deckard had the time in a second or two to become furiously angry with Charles Gould, and even resentful against Mrs. Gould, in whose care, tacitly it is true, he had left the safety of Antonia. Better perish a thousand times than owe your preservation to such people, he exclaimed mentally. The grip of Nostromo's fingers never removed from his shoulder, tightening fiercely, recalled him to himself. The darkness is our friend, the Capitas murmured into his ear. I am going to lower the sail, and trust our escape to this black gulf. No eyes could make us out lying silent with a naked mast. I will do it now, before this steamer closes still more upon us. The faint creak of a block would betray us, and the Santome treasure into the hands of those thieves. He moved about as warily as a cat. Deckard heard no sound, and it was only by the disappearance of the square blotch of darkness that he knew the yard had come down, lowered as carefully as if it had been made of glass. Next moment he heard Nostromo's quiet breathing by his side. You had better not move at all from where you are, Don Martin, advised the Capitas, earnestly. Why, you might stumble, or displace something which would make a noise. The sweeps and the punting poles are lying about. Move not for your life. Poor Dios, Don Martin, he went on in a keen but friendly whisper, I am so desperate, that if I didn't know your worship, to be a man of courage, capable of standing stock still whatever happens, I would drive my knife into your heart. A death-like stillness surrounded the lighter. It was difficult to believe that there was near a steamer full of men with many pairs of eyes peering from her bridge for some hint of land in the night. Her steam had ceased blowing off, and she remained stopped too far off apparently for any other sound to reach the lighter. Perhaps you would, Capitas, Deckard began in a whisper. However, you need not trouble. There are other things than the fear of your knife, to keep my heart steady. It shall not betray you. Only, have you forgotten, I spoke to you openly, as to a man as desperate as myself, explained the Capitas. The silver must be saved from the Monterists. I told Captain Mitchell three times that I preferred to go alone. I told Don Carlos Gould to. It was in the Casa Gould. They had sent for me. The ladies were there, and when I tried to explain why I did not wish to have you with me, they promised me, both of them, great rewards for your safety. A strange way to talk to a man you are sending out to an almost certain death. Those gentlefolk do not seem to have sense enough to understand what they are giving one to do. I told them I could do nothing for you. You would have been safer with the bandit Hernandez. It would have been possible to ride out of the town. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.